and I are the program guide, or
Aiden and I are the program guide, gives you what we're doing in each month. So October we're starting to do short things. Get some plates here. Help yourself there, okay? Okay, so you see our two topics of discussion for this month will be Yehoshua and Gideon. The analyze the facts of Jesus, the two of our greatest notes are here in the newly settled land of Israel. We're going to do much more than that. As you can see, month by month, we're really traveling quite a distance around Tanakh. Yeah, they keep a few of them.
Okay, but we're on time for you. Yeah. Well, at
least
you left me the bigger piece.
I'm not taking it. I know, but
it's
only
you like
chocolate? Do you need something else
to
drink? You like chocolate or
the candy? I think there was a bottle of water. Yeah, I should have some more.
The shop?
Write me a word.
Don't tell me if you like it. That would be very noble.
Yeah. We have a knife here to cut the cake.
Put a little more.
Actually, cut it with a fork. Oh, very well. Yeah. What kind of cake? Good
cake. Okay. All right, so in order to understand Yehoshua and Sefer Yehoshua, I think we should certainly understand this negative in your mind. What's important to do is to understand Yehoshua's emergence. Yehoshua's emergence in various places in the Torah. Time we ever see Yehoshua in the Torah is where Amalek fights against us in the back lines. Right? And Moshe tells Yehoshua to subdue them. So the Yehoshua we will end up knowing as the military hero, right, starts off in his very first appearance for Moshe in a military capacity. Now, most people do not look at Yehoshua this way, but give me the opening line in Perkei Avos, please. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. It's with Yehoshua. Yehoshua is the first person to have gotten smicha. Right? And yet, we do not, if you looked up a compendium of Midrashim on biblical characters, of Nishay Tanakh, and you look up every Medrash ever written about Yehoshua, and you'll find that most of what is said about Yehoshua comes to us in the realm of a military capacity, and very little from a Torah capacity. You may know Gemara Megillah, Gemara Erevin, where he's learning Torah in the field at night, remember the angel comes to him, remember that story there, but certainly in the Navi, In the Tanakh material that we have, we don't see Yehoshua sitting down with the people and teaching Torah like a Moshe, like an Ezra. You know, right? So we're going to have to deal with that. There's actually two fascinating Gemaras on this. One is a Gemara in Erevin that says that Yehoshua was actually among the weaker students. Right? His role in the base of Medrash was. Now, by the way, how this Medrash knows this about Yehoshua, I said there's some tradition. That's the important point. point is that the Bala Medrash felt that the one Moshe gave smicha to was not necessarily the greatest Talmud. That's a very powerful message in itself, as you'll see in a moment. His main job in the Beis Medrash was to make sure that the Sfarim were all in place, that he used to sweep the floor, as the Medrash says, before Shabbos, right, to prepare the Beis Medrash for Shabbos. He was there to make sure that everyone could find the Rambam on the shelf, and they could find the Ramban in the right place, to get the picture. The point that the Medrash is trying to say is that not everyone, even the one who ends up leading the yeshiva, right, the biggest lamdan, the Netziv, very famous story about the Netziv, was not the greatest of students. And he just had the greatest drive. Sometimes it's drive that makes up for some other lacks. In any event, Yehoshua was supposed to be Moshe's, the continuation of Moshe in the learning or the law giving aspect. And the reason why he lost it is the Gemara in Sefer Tzemura that says that when Moshe died, many doubts came up in halacha. And Hashem went to Yehoshua and said, Yehoshua, can I help to fortify you? Do you need any help with your fortification of Torah now that your master is dead? And Yehoshua said, no, I'm fine. I'm going to remember everything. So that was the sort of his undoing. Hashem asked Yehoshua.
That's what he said?
And Yehoshua said, I'm fine. I'm going to manage. I don't need any help. So don't just see what the point is. That Yehoshua's claim to fame is that he diminished himself to help keep arrange the books in the Beis Medrash. Right? That's why he comes to Gedula. As soon as that turns to arrogance, now that I'm in charge, as soon as that turns to arrogance, then we lose Yehoshua as the. Anyone ever remember seeing a picture of Yehoshua in Tanakh? As a lawgiver, he's not. He's a military hero. In fact, have any of you been to West Point lately?
Yeah.
You ever see what's at the front of West Point? A big statue of what they consider to be the greatest military hero of all time. Joshua. There's a statue of Joshua in the front of West Point. So I'm not using West Point as a riot, but I'm sure that all of you came in today, you were not probably not preparing to hear words about Yehoshua from a Torah standpoint. So that's why it says technical genius of our two greatest military heroes. All right. So the first time he enters the fray is in the conquest of Amalek.
But we have only here as one
waiting
for Moshe.
It's coming up. First time we see him, it's in a military capacity. Yes?
What about, I feel like most people also identify with
Malachi. That's coming up too. I have nine places where Yeshua is mentioned in the Torah. And this is the first one. Each one we'll analyze in order to understand how all of them fit into the Yehoshua that we see in the Sefer. Just let me tell you one other a little chiddush. That I'm not really going to work on this, to develop this, but it's a fascinating chiddush that Yehoshua is the fulfillment, Sefer Yehoshua is the fulfillment of one small chapter in Sefer Bereishis. Can you consider back to Sefer Bereishis? What chapter of Sefer Bereishis is, I mean, it's uncanny. It's the ultimate fulfillment historically of what Sefer Yehoshua is.
Promise to Abraham.
More than that. That's just one statement.
We would say the four kings.
Much more than that. It's significant. It's just that you're each mentioning one point. It's a whole series of points. Give it away by telling you the number, 12 to be exact. This is an amazing thesis. It's made by Das Mikra, it's made by a number of Mefarshim. That, I haven't given it away yet.
the allotment of the land?
Namely, it
is
Parshas Vayechi has Yaakov calling his 12 sons over to his bedside, telling them what's going to happen to them in the future. Everything he says to each one is manifest in Sefer Yehoshua. For instance, he tells Shimon and Levi, "You two of you really vexed me with what you did to those people in Shechem. I'm going to scatter you amongst the Jews." Levi gets no land of his own. Shimon, it says in Sefer Yehoshua at the end of the Sefer, Shimon received no land. They assimilated into within Yehuda. And I can show you this with every one of the tribes. That Yehoshua, but not in the conquest part. Yehoshua has two parts. The conquest of the land and the division of the land. The division of the land is the fulfillment of Parshas Vayechi. That's it. And the Parshas Vayechi of Yaakov giving his last testament to his sons. Right? That's the part known as the Chalukat Haaretz, the division of the land. The part that we are concentrating on is the Kibush Haaretz. Okay? I see also Yehoshua at the end of the book. What I'm doing now is really I'm pruning away all of that I'm not going to do in Yehoshua, so that we'll be free to discuss what we will be doing. Yehoshua, at the very end, when they finally entered the land, we're ready to get things started, we're ready to tithe our grain, we're ready to keep Shemitah, none of which was kept during the years of conquest and the years of division. Now that we're ready, or at least not in the years of conquest, we're ready to start this great experiment of L'Sakin Olam B'Malchus Shakai in our holy land. And the first thing that happens is something that can theoretically rip the nation apart. And I'm only telling you this to get a picture of what Yehoshua was able to do that I'm not sure if Moshe did as well. I'm not blaming it on Moshe, but it's just a matter of fact. Allow me to explain. The tribes of Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe, who were on the other side of the Yarden, right? You all know that. They asked for that land because it was good for their nickname. The tribes that were on the other side of the Yarden, just as they entered the land, built a tall structure, a mizbeach, an altar to God. This was anathema to the remaining tribes who were in Israel because Torah on many occasions, in Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Devarim, warns the Jews, you may not offer sacrifice outside of the precincts of the holy temple, whether it's called the Olam Moed, wherever it stands. That time it stood in a place called Gilgal. You cannot bring Kavanos in that place. And because Reuven and God and Chatzi Menashe built an altar, the other tribes assumed that they would offer sacrifice there. Right? And they prepared for war. I mean, they had just finished the battle to conquer Canaan, and right away, we're fighting each other. 2.5 tribes against 9.5 tribes. Yehoshua stopped it. And the people, Yehoshua gave, with Pinchas, together with Pinchas, convinced the 2.5, the 9.5 tribes to do what? One of the most important things in conflict. To do what? What? Give them a chance to explain themselves. Talk. Usually you see something wrong, the first place you jump is to conclusions, and then there's no dialogue and you just misunderstand each other. So the two and a half tribes explained themselves that we didn't want to offer a sacrifice here. We just wanted to build a reminder to our sons that just because we're living on this side of the Jordan doesn't mean we're not part of the nation. And they forestalled a terrible tragedy right at the beginning of our kingdom to fight each other like this. Right? So Yehoshua is certainly a peacekeeper. Right? He very successful. You do not see the people rebelling against him the way they rebelled against Moshe. Right? And he is phenomenally successful. In 32 battles, he lost one. In that one battle, he lost 36 men. And after that battle, he started fetching to God. How are you not supporting us here in this campaign, God? We can't suffer any losses. right? Start to get me the, they'll bring out the reporters, and they'll bring out the, second guessers, but he only works one. Okay, let's get back to Yahushua and the Torah. The next time we see Yahushua in the Torah is where he hears noise in the camp of Israel as he sees Moshe coming down the mountain. Right? The first person that Moshe runs into is Yahushua. Now, when Moshe went up to the mountain from the camp of the people, whom did he put in charge? Aaron and Hur. Aaron and Hur, not Yahushua. Which is, by the way, why Chazal insists, as Rashi brings down, that Hur was killed. They tried to stop them from making the Egel, they killed him. And then Aaron said, you know, if they kill me, then they're really in trouble. No leadership whatsoever. So let me at least, I'll be the bad guy. I'll give up on myself. Let me at least be here to oversee the situation. Why did Chazal insist that Hur was killed? Where did they get that from? Because if Moshe went up to the mountain and put Hur in charge, right? And then, when Moshe descends from the mountain, do you know that the name Hur never again appears in the whole Torah? I mean, he must have been a chash of a guy. He was put in charge after all, right? Not Yahushua, Hur. Right? But they killed him. Where was Yahushua during the Egel? He was someplace in the middle.
Just giving directions.
Went up with Moshe. He was not part of that group. He was up the mountain when Moshe came down. Okay? That's because we're told later, Lo Yamush Yahushua. Yahushua did not leave Moshe. He went as far up as he could go. Did Yahushua go? He went even further up than Aaron. Okay? At one point, Moshe said, listen, Yahushua, if you go any further, you'll die. Something like that, I don't know. But Yahushua was the first one he bumped into on the way down. Right? You see, by only mentioning Hur, by not mentioning Yahushua, it would appear that at that early stage, Yahushua had not defined himself yet. We're going to see one by one that Yahushua defines himself in various ways. At least of which is standing up to the Temple. Although, you know, Yahushua is not the one who really seems to stand up. Go back to Parsha Shlach. Who's the one that really stands up to the other? We'll discuss that shortly. I mean, when, for instance, in next week's Parsha, not Noah, but in the Parsha afterwards, when Abraham complains to God, God, what are you doing? You keep promising me I'm going to be a great nation, and look who's inheriting me. What does he say?
Eliezer.
What does that show? What does that show you about his relationship with Lot? He didn't consider him part of his family. Usually a man is first going to say that, and God, look, come on, what are you going to do for me? My nephew is inheriting me. Why didn't he say that? Your nephew before you are your servant. Right? You hear it? That statement says more about who's not mentioned than about who is mentioned. So too here. Yahushua is not mentioned as the one in charge for the people. Now that could be for a number of reasons. Some of our should know this and say, because Moshe did not want to put Yahushua in charge. Either because he knew how easily corruptible he might be, he might give in, right? Or because he wanted him up with him. I want you coming up with me. I want you to be close by. I want you to get as close as you can. Okay? Got it? Fine. So that's the next time we see him. Now, two other times he is called Mishares Moshe. He starts to distinguish himself because he is always at Moshe's side. Right? You find in Chazal that the only way to become a true Talmud Chacham is to be a Mishares of Chacham. Even if no matter how much you learn yourself, no matter how much you do your homework, and how gifted you are, you have to sit and drive around the Talmud Chacham for some time. Just do it. That's what Yahushua became. Now, it's not always the greatest Chacham who does the driving, because the best driver does the driving. Okay? So, And as a result, Yahushua got the ins and outs for being the Mishares. Okay? So that's what we, how we see him even later on when Moshe is arguing with God on behalf of Israel. Yahushua appears there as the Mishares Moshe. Yes?
Isn't there that famous story of where the where they asked the servant of, maybe the commissioner, where they asked the servant of rabbi as to what the halacha is?
Yes, it's a Gemara in a number of places. And it's the, you know, the Amstut the Rebbe, the handmaid, the maidservant of Rebbe, who they would ask for certain things. So, listen, you're there all the time with him. You hardly ever get in an audience, and you're there all the time with him. Right? Or the elders and the noblemen get to see the king on a rare occasion, and then very formally. You know, ask the one who cleans his floor, and he cleans out his tails and things. That he's the one who gets in on the inside. That's what Yahushua was at this early stage, and that's exactly how the Talmud presents him and the Midrashim present him. The one sweeping up in the Beis Medrash before Shabbos, the one making sure the books are all in place. That's an amazing picture that they create of Yahushua as such. Okay. That's why you look in the Gemara, Erev Shabbos, you see all the great Tanoim and Amoraim were sweeping up, and they wanted it. They didn't want Shabbos. They could cover for the queen. Okay, the next time we see Yahushua in Tanakh, I'm up to number four now. The next time he is very jealous of Moshe. Remember that story? Eldad and Medad. Now, he may be jealous of himself, too. How come these guys get to get prophecy and I don't? We do not see Yahushua in a prophetic mode yet. Right? But he's jealous of Moshe, right? It's very interesting. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in Kuflam and Gimel, in the first year of Deya, over how you're supposed to address your Rebbe to... Or for that matter, how are you supposed to address anyone who deserves your cover? It could be an elderly grandmother, or it could be a rebbe. It could be, they say, it's a kumen, an elderly person. I'm discussing that this morning at the Shabbos. So, Rav Moshe cites the Shach in Yoredeya, who indicates that when you address the rebbe directly, you must speak in third person. Certainly may not mention that person's name in presence. Okay. Which, by the way, seems to indicate that, unlike Rashi said, but like Chizkuni says that it's Esav who speaks with more respect than Yaakov. Because Yaakov says, Kum nosha boga ahu amit seidi ba'bur v'tzrachani nafshecha. He says, please rise and eat from my foods so that you can bless me. Esav says, Yakum avivi ochal mitzei beno. Let my father get up and eat from his son's food. You hear it? He speaks in third person, which is always considered more respect. In our society, we capitalize I wherever it appears. In some other societies, we capitalize you. I is a small I. You is always a capital Y wherever it is in a sentence.
What
society
is doing?
I think it's German.
No, German capitalizes every noun.
Every noun?
Denmark.
Denmark? Yeah. Okay, in any event, this is an honorific reference. So the Torah Tzmima asks on the Shach, what about Adonim Moshe Kiloim? When Yahushua saw Eldad Medad giving his prophecy, which Chazal say was really disparaging to Moshe, about Moshe not going into the land, right? Remember the Rosh Tevos, Misnabim, Bine Eldad Medad Misnabim B'Toch HaMachane. So the Gemara says that Misnabim stands for Rosh Tevos. Moshe, Tanua, Nacho, Bar, Yahushua, Machni Singh. Moshe is going to die here in the desert. Yahushua is bringing them in. You see? So, the prophecy they were giving was actually very positive for Yahushua. At that early time, for Yahushua to contemplate, what? I'm taking them into Israel? Are you kidding me? Yahushua still hasn't defined himself. Right? Yahushua didn't win that battle, by the way. Moshe's hands did. Okay? And yet, Yahushua hears this and can't stand it. Either because, there's not genuine humility for this. Chas v'shalom, in front of your Rebbe, you're telling me that he's, at this early stage, they were expecting to go right into Israel a few weeks later. Right? Before the Meraglim, it was Miriam's leprosy that made them delay. They were going right into Israel two weeks later from there. And of course the tragedy of Meraglim is right on the heels. But at this time, Moshe, who just took us out of Egypt less than a year ago, is dying in the desert? What are you kidding? That's insane. And I'm taking them in? Well, where are you coming from? Adoni, Moshe, Kla'ain, silence them. Right? So the Torah Tzmimah says something outrageous. He says the Shach forgot about this pasuk. If the Shach saw this pasuk, he never would have said that you have to speak to your Rebbe in third person. Right? You hear it? Because Yahushua is talking to Moshe to his face, and he says Moshe's name right to his face. All right, he said Adoni Moshe. He didn't say Moshe. He said my master Moshe. Right? So, all right, so the Torah Tzmimah says that. But Rav Moshe gives a different answer. Rav Moshe says, there's about three different answers, but one of the answers is that you can't claim, even if the Shach is correct, you can't claim that Yahushua was being disrespectful here. Right? The whole essence of what he's saying, it's not like he said, Adoni Moshe, give me some tickets for the playoff games. You know, it was Adoni Moshe. The whole point of it was, this is lifting me up at your expense. I don't want to hear it. Silence them. Okay? And this is the same Yahushua that we're used to. Great humility. Okay? You know, David seems to have this humility also in Sefer Shmuel, where Shaul is constantly accusing David of what? Wanting to take his power, wanting to become king. At every turn, David never gives up his guard. David knows he's going to become king, right? Because he's been crowned by Shmuel. Right? But he never lets on that he expects to become king. You know, when people talk to him and say, you're such a great warrior and you're marrying the king's daughter, don't you see that there's a certain destiny being spelled out to you? And he says, oh, please, I'm a nobody. I'm a struggling man. Please, don't talk like this. So Shaul starts, he's running after, he's chasing, he's to run here, he's to run there. The history of David's flight from Shaul is really a tragedy. The one person who's saving you from these Philistines, you're trying on down, right? So twice, David has the opportunity to kill Shaul and doesn't, and lets Shaul know it. He holds up his canteen and his spear, he holds up a corner of his jacket, and both times Shaul swears that I'm never going to attack you again. He attacks him again, and then the second time, he says, you know, David, I see that you're a better man than I am. I know you're going to be the next king of Israel. Just swear to me that when you become king, that you will not kill my grandchildren. Wow. It's a tough thing for a king to say. Incidentally, in chapter 9 of Shmuel Bet, when David looks for Shaul's grandchildren to take good care of them, it says, David did this because of the promise he made to Yonatan. And before Shemez, wait, he made that promise to Shaul. He says, yeah, but Shaul went back on that promise. You know why? Because David made a mistake. What should David have answered when offered that question? Promise me you won't kill my grandchildren when you become king.
I'm not going
to become king. King? Who's talking about king? You keep talking about king. I don't expect to become king. Your son, my best friend, is going to be the next king. Now, that would be an outright lie. Maybe Tobit just can't lie like that. Right? But he had been talking that way all along in Shmuel, Sefer Shmuel, when the other servants talked to him about marrying the king's daughter, etc. So maybe he avoided an outright lie, but this would be an outright lie. I don't expect him. Of course he expects him to come to you. So, Lemaisa, what comes out of here is that when David says, yes, I will not kill your grandchildren. Shaul tried to kill him again the next day. So Shaul went back on his promise, David went back on his. So that his promise to look after Shaul's grandchildren was not a promise made to Shaul, but a promise made to Yonatan. Back to our point. Yahushua behaves like David throughout Shmuel. At this point, certainly there's no reason for him to have any expectation of taking the name Israel. So he is very, very contrite. And when he hears this prophecy, he really tries to shut them down. Even though the prophecy is good for himself. Right? Okay, next. The next time, of course, that we see Yahushua, because it's right, it's a few, 15, 20 psukim later, is when he's sent together with 11 other scouts to report on the land. Now here's the tragedy, you see, and here's really a very fertile area of discussion. I think we might start next week with this. But I want to draw for you, and maybe you can start to prepare or do a little homework, is I want to compare the mission of Moshe sending the scouts into the land and the mission of Yahushua in Atzoret Parash Shlach, of Yahushua's mission of sending in scouts to scout out Knan, or in that case Yericho. And I mean, how did Moshe make the mistake? How did that happen? I mean, for goodness sakes, I love flying throughout Tanakh. When Yirmiyahu threatened the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the end of the Commonwealth, the Jews said, impossible! God would never destroy his own temple, and besides, the God who took us out of Egypt is much stronger than these Babylonians. These are these faithless Jews who Yirmiyahu railed against throughout the whole Sefer. Would it be that these 12 scouts would have such similar faith? The God who took us out of Egypt can destroy these giants or whatever else we face here. Why didn't they say this? I'm not here to discuss Parsha Shlach with you, but what was Moshe thinking when he sent 12 famous men? Who do you send on a spy mission? Congressmen? These are politicians. You don't send politicians, right? So why did Moshe send and announce? You announce spies? I mean, come on. I understand that right now the Democratic Congress wants to have more of a, you know, oversight of anything that George Bush might do with Iran. But when you tell 450-some-odd congressmen about a covert action that we're planning in order to prevent the nuclear proliferation, one of those congressmen is going to leak it out to someone. I mean, you can't start a battle that way. Battles have to be fought. See, that's why the president is in charge of doing that, not 450 politicians, one of which we may spill the beans, right? Even inadvertently. So why, Moshe, are you sending 12 famous people on a spy mission and publicizing it? Do you know what the answer to that question is? Very simple answer is?
Let's try to be
you're speaking in contemporary terms, Renee. But because we're mistaken if we think that Moshe's mission was a spy mission. It wasn't. Well, there's some elements of it, to be sure, what type of people there are, how is the land. But it's very clear that Moshe's mission was, the word l'ragel never appears. It says, latur et arts, to scout the land. Call them scouts. They made of themselves more than Moshe wanted them. That's why there's this amazing kliyokar in Parshas Shlach that says, that, you know, there's a contradiction between Shlach and Dvarim. In Dvarim it says that Moshe, together with the people, worked out this mission. Hashem never commands that. Hashem gives Moshe the instructions. So Rashi says, well, what is it? Is it God or is it Moshe? So Rashi says, God said to Moshe, listen, I have a plan about this your entry into the land. This is what I would do, but if you want to, you can send me scouts. This is what you can do if you want to. So the Kleokra says one step further, he says, true, but if God doesn't go on Shlach Lecha, it goes Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Moshe, you're probably inclined to send men on this mission. I would send women. If you send women, you're going to get an accurate report. There's no hubris, there's no arrogance. They're just going to go in there, they're going to see, and they're going to write down, and they're going to report. Men are going to come and make more of it, more of themselves than what they are. It's amazing. First, take a look on the word Anoshim, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Okay, fair enough. But are you familiar with the fact that when they go into the land, Yehoshua's name is changed? Right? It's named from Hoshea to Yehoshua. That in itself shows a metamorphosis. In fact, it happens very often in Tanakh. It happens with Abram, it happens with Yaakov, it happens with Yosef, especially. That's the real clear example of someone changing the name of a person in a leadership position to either show you that you answer to me, or right, there are some conquests where a king changes the name of another king and says, okay, now I'm in charge of you. But Yeshua getting a name from Moshe to Yeshua, let's put aside right now what the name is changed to, we'll get to that in a moment. But the very essence of changing the name means that Moshe has some good plans for this guy. He's starting to identify himself. He's loyal to me, right? He's Eldo the Meda. He doesn't leave my side. He's my shamus, my misharis. He's good in battle. I like this guy. Now about the Yud. Hoshea to Yehoshua. Right? Seems to imply he will save. By the way, it's very interesting. If you look at all the names of the scouts, they all seem to have names that bespeak salvation and something secretive. Yigal ben Sodi. There's a guy named Michael ben Sisur. Sisur means hidden. Right? Nachbi. Nachbi? For goodness sakes, Nachbi means hidden. Mamish. All these names, hidden salvation. It sounds like a very cutesy kind of drug. It's like a mother, Sefer Sota. Right? There's hidden salvation here, and I wanted to give, even if he himself won't recognize it, but a name change that implies that he will bring salvation to my people. But you've also heard that the Yud was to spare him from. Remember? What does he need help with the number 10?
The other 10.
So you have to stand up to the other 10. Right? Okay. Why didn't Kohen get such a gift? So some of Farshim say Yada didn't need it. Another very interesting parish is that Hashem actually says the only people who are coming into Israel from those who went in, those who left Egypt, by a certain age, are Kolev and Yehoshua. And so the Pasuk only says why Kolev gets to come in. It doesn't say Yehoshua. It just says Yehoshua. Kolev is standing up from Ravin. Ki b'Kolev ha'yavo ruach acheres. He had a different mindset than the 10 bad ones. It doesn't say anything about Yehoshua. And this is how I think can be explained, is that Yehoshua was not of a different mindset. He was a perfect mindset. He's been in training all this time, and Moshe gave him this yud, sort of to boost it. Kolev was a ruach acheres, means Kolev was originally on the side of the ten. He had to struggle with himself to turn away from that. So who gets the more reward for what they did? Kolev. The Torah ignores Yehoshua. Big deal. You got the Yud. You got the blessing from Moshe. You've been up with him at the mountain. You're his Mishares. What else would we expect from you? It's Kali who deserves the respect, because he had to struggle to get this, to come to this. So the Torah doesn't even tell us what Yeshua's reaction to this whole thing was. It just tells us how it is. Because it's a function of how much you work towards it. By the way, if you want to just fit in an interesting agadita in this, you know that, you ever hear of a point that Yehoshua's yud came from someone else? So that's why he's called, some sofer says, Yehoshua bin Nun. He's always bin. What's his bin? Right? I mean, some are bin Laden. Well, what do you mean, Yehoshua bin Nun? Bin Nun, right? So it's Yehoshua bin Nun. Everyone else is Ben. David Ben Yishai. There's no one else in Old Tanakh who's bin. Where's that come from? Can you figure it out? What? Namely?
What
does it mean? Two dots. So you had to borrow two dots from the segel under the base of Ben. If you can come up with a better explanation than this, please tell me. You feel it? You hear it? There's a shva under the yud. Right? The word Ben has three dots. So you borrowed two dots from the Ben, and you put it under the yud. Now there's only one dot under the Ben, so it's Yehoshua bin Nun.
And the dot system goes back to...
No, it doesn't. It's a very... That dot system is... Not even at the time of the Talmud, but...
Okay.
You can say that it was... done that on purpose, knowing what the system would be in the future. Alright, so that's the name change to Yehoshua. Something very interesting is that at the end of Dvarim, when Yehoshua Mamish takes over from Moshe, do you know what he's called the last time he's mentioned in the barn?
Hoshea.
Would you believe it? It's back to Hoshea? Are you listening? In Mezuzah Bracha. Isn't that strange? The last time you mention him, you're going back to Hoshea? So then, Siv said a very interesting drash from this. Yes, you have an explanation.
No, I'm just thinking, why don't we say in that case, Emutamei Muhabatora?
Oh, that's just what it says. It says, Moshe, listen, you can go, Mamish going up to the mountain now. Put your hands on Yehoshua, come up and die, and clearly at the very end. So every event of Tvarim is after every event in Shmos from the Vayikra. Tvarim is the last month of Moshe's life. So then the Tziv said something very interesting. And this, and whether it's Pshat or not, I don't know if we can do anything but a drash. One time, one of the Tziv students came up to him and asked for a bracha. I said, because I'm getting my own shteller and I'm becoming a rabbi of a community, can you give me a bracha for success? He said, I'm sorry, pal, you're on your own. A rabbi has to just make his own luck by doing all the right things, being a good politician and running. You know, a Rosh Yeshiva, you can give a bracha. You had the Sanhedrin, you can give a bracha. When you become a head of the Mishra, the community, you can't give a bracha for that. What was the raya? Because when Yehoshua became the head of the community, he lost his yud, the yud of protection. I can give you a yud to protect you from the Maraglin. But once you take my place, you're back to Hoshea. Just for that one time, then he's called Yehoshua in general afterwards. That's a very interesting point. But by calling him Hoshea the very last time he's mentioned in the Torah is a sign of with respect to Moshe. Just know, Yehoshua, your whole entire Mahus comes from Moshe. I would like to take you just to read the first parak. First parak of Sefer Yehoshua. The rest of Yehoshua's references in the Torah is where Moshe gives him smicha. Right? And where Moshe commands Yehoshua to have strength in order to take over the land. You know, when Moshe begs God, please God, I beg, give the Jews a leader who will take them into the land, who will suffer their differences, who will understand each one as a separate individual. Please God, give them a good leader. That Moshe says that right after the Benos Tzlofchad beg God for an inheritance from their father. What's the connection between the daughters of Tzlofchad and Moshe begging God that to not leave them without a leader when he dies?
Because he didn't know the answer.
last. Good. It's a very excellent connection. Think of another connection, though. What the Nos Tzavta were asking something about taking over from their father, and they got a good response from God.
Right.
They got the response they wanted. Why do you think Moshe is saying this? Moshe is not happy that Yerusha was taking over everything. He wants his son to take over. He's hoping that God, he gave the Nos Tzavta a good answer. Moshe can't mention, his own sons, but some unfortunate say he's hoping that God will find something for his sons to do. What an avah! I'm going to all this Gedulah and my sons are. Hashem says, listen, Torah is not a Yerusha. I have to give the job to the best guy. That's what I'm going to do. I mean, the Jewish world is suffering today very much by leaders of movements who don't pass on their leadership smoothly to a son. It's ripping apart Babov, who's famous for not letting that happen, but it's ripping apart Babov now. It's destroying Sadmer. He'll excuse me, I think it's not done anything good for Lubavitch, although they seem to be doing okay. But can you read, please, that's fine, I know my time is mamash ending, but can you read just a few psukim in Perek Aleph of Yehoshua? Read yourself like 6, 7, 8 psukim. And I want to, while you're reading, introduce you to a concept that Nechama Leibowitz really worked on. It's called Milat Mancho. Milat Mancho. Now what Milat Mancho means is a word constantly stressed in a story. Like in the story of the Akedah, the word constantly stressed is of and ben. Every pasuk has the word of and ben in it. That Milat Mancha identifies the nature of the story. Don't forget, there's a father and son here, even though the son and father is doing not a very fatherly thing. In almost every story, there's a Milat Mancha. Sometimes it only appears once or twice. Like, Vayakum Kain al Hebel, Vayamar Kain al Hebel Achiv. Vayamar Kain al Hebel Achiv. Where a word that appears that you... So you can't help but see Chazak Ve'Matzir. You can't help but see that. But I want you for homework for next week, look for another word that appears inordinately in our parak.
In the entire parak.
Too many times. I think it's 9 times. So I don't want to give it away now. Don't say it yet, because I want you all to prepare it. Okay? And if you don't mind, I would like to, if you would put down the names in the mail, because Chas V'Shalom, sometimes on a Monday night I have a sudden emergency. I want you to be able to get emails on Monday afternoon. Although I don't understand them. Maybe I have some Monday weddings in a couple of weeks next week, so I'm not even going to that. I really don't want to miss this. But what I want to do is give you get your information, just Chas V'Shalom, so in case something happens. Here we go. Tell me, how was the chocolate little flour cake?
Gone. Gone. They were delicious.
Oh, wait.
Who made those?
The big hefty. Scratch herself alone in the house. By herself. Recipe book with the mold. You know, because the mold is a nice mold. Yeah, nice mold.
Very nice.
The door, I'm going to say that you didn't finish it.
Yeah.
We have different molds. Yes. I think it's the beginning of Yehoshua, and I believe so. But it's just uncanny how Vayechi is unfolds in every trial.
Played out?
Yes, it's as if though.
Right after he like turned it out.
Yeah, it's in the Sefer also. It's as if though Yoshua is written with an eye towards keeping what's going on later. It's amazing. Okay. We're going to need, if you have, a Miklos Gedolos Yoshua. So if you can't do it from home, I have three or four here. And of course the full Tanakh, because we like to go through all the Tanakh. Okay? Our next year in Poland is about to start.